This is Kate Brownfield from ADHD Kids Can Thrive. Today I have a special guest with me. His name is Scott Spradlin. He's a therapist and team lead at Wichita DBT at North Star Therapy. He is also an author of his book called Don't Let Your Emotions Run Your Life, How DBT Can Put You in Control. Scott is very knowledgeable in DBT, ADHD, mindfulness, mental health, and psychotherapy. I invited Scott to join us today on this podcast to help us understand and become more educated in DBT therapy as a tool for those who struggle with ADHD. Thank you for being here, Scott. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Absolutely. Okay, so I'm really looking forward to this conversation and the education that you're going to provide to all of us about exactly what ADHD is and how it can help people who have ADHD. So let's start kind of from the top about what exactly is DBT therapy.
Okay, yeah, great, obvious, important question. DBT or dialectical behavior therapy is a what's called a third wave cognitive behavioral therapy, which was founded and developed by Marcia Linehan. And, this came from work of hers working with chronically suicidal borderline personality disorder diagnosed patients in the Seattle, Washington area. And it's a model of therapy that it embraces polarities, and extremes and emotion and thinking and behavior. And it's comprehensive, it's principle-based. And of course, it's become established as a leading evidence-based therapy for the treatment of BPD. And also over the course of history has become a therapy that's been modified to help with some other struggles or diagnostic populations, including ADHD, eating disorders, and substance abuse problems. So that's where we start. So starting with Marcia Linehan, that's kind of the real quick nutshell. So we'll see what else I can say.
Yeah, that's okay. So how did it evolve, DBT evolve into this viable treatment for those who struggle with ADHD? I feel like it's a therapeutic treatment now that's getting a lot of buzz and momentum as a solution to help those who do struggle with ADHD.
At present, what I would say about, like I mentioned, when Marshall Linehan was developing DBT, and it was really getting its a big traction really publicly in the early 90s, that's when she first published her main book, Cognitive Behavioral Treatment for Borderline Personality Disorder, and her treatment manual that came along with that.
Yeah. Okay, so that was probably like 25 years ago that she was kind of coming into
that's when she into was the really, know. I think she was becoming more known. Of course, I was a baby therapist. So, when I was first exposed to DBT living in Portland, Oregon at the time. And then, of course, I completed my intensive training with Dr. Linehan and Linda DeMaff, who is now running the Portland DBT Institute. She'd been working on this at least since the 80s. So the work has, been going on for, this is her life's work, really, in evolving over time. And that, basically, as I remember her telling the story is, when she in Seattle, she basically invited local practitioners and hospitals to send her and her clinic the worst of the worst as far as their patients go. And just incidentally, the people that they were working with and interacting with, so they weren't going out looking for treating BPD per se, but just who are the most complicated cases that we can try to help with. And this is, in part the seed evolution, seeds for the evolution of DBT has developed over time. And then keeping track of diagnostics, with her research team, discovered that, the majority of the folks that they were treating effectively met criteria for BPD and who were also chronically suicidal. One of the key factors about DBT is that it really hones in on the nature of emotion dysregulation and I'd say clinically sort of reconceptualizing the problem with BPD as a failure in emotion dysregulation. And that means then that the assumption from a like DBT biosocial model to understand that is that the folks we're dealing with in treatment and assisting are biologically predisposed, perhaps genetically and otherwise, to already being wired in such a way where they have a hair trigger, threat detection. So they're kind of, they're hypersensitive to emotional stimuli. So they experience their emotions very intensely. And they maybe have disproportionately strong emotional reactions to events in the environment then that are in part related to, very extreme behaviors of discontrol or impulsivity, which, present themselves perhaps as suicidality or other problems in impulsivity, erratic, behaviors within relationships. And a lot of those disordered behaviors are considered in some way an attempt to solve problems with that emotion dysregulation. So really looking at that difficulty of regulating emotions has become the way I would look at it, that becomes a platform from which we started, other DBT researchers and practitioners were looking at, well, we have folks, for instance, with binge eating disorder or discontrolled eating, and seeing if what would happen if we reconceptualize that as a problem, and again, emotion dysregulation, that behavior pattern may be a way to that person seeking a way to regulate, modulate how they experience those emotions in their day-to-day life.
And ADHD people tend to have a hard time regulating their emotions.
Absolutely. And of course, like I said, I don't know if there's a big buzz about that, but, folks like Russell Barkley, Russell Ramsey, who are well-known ADHD researchers and practitioners, certainly identify the emotion dysregulation component as something that's really under-recognized among clinicians and isn't even part of the DSM criteria for ADHD.
But yeah, and it's actually, though, in the home, probably what is breaking families the most is the emotional dysregulation. And I think a lot of parents don't know how to help their child with that particular piece, right? Because it's very challenging. And it's probably, it's difficult, I think, for parents to figure out how to help their child learn how to manage their emotions. So I think, well, what I've found in my own research is CBT is always talked about. And there's always a lot of talk about how ADHD boys especially do not do well with talk therapy. But overall in ADHD, they say the two main factors that can support somebody with ADHD would be medication and therapy. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of conflicting advice, I think, coming to parents about what is the appropriate steps to take to help your child. And what I found interesting, so I would say the experts just say therapy, and then you tend to see a lot of talk and buzz about CBT being very helpful. Mm-hmm. But then when I learned a little bit more about what DBT is and what you're talking about, DBT tends to be more not like talk therapy, but more thinking and skill development. Am I right in thinking that?
It is very, it's very oriented to skill building for sure. Absolutely. Yeah. Standard DBT, which would be this is the comprehensive nature of standard DBT. That would involve an individual being involved with an individual therapist on a weekly basis, where we would say that's where the real therapy happens. That's where folks are really working on building skill and motivation capabilities and generalizing with the help of that relationship, really implementing those skills where they really need them in their day-to-day life. In addition to that, then there's a concurrent attendance of DBT skills training groups, which are not kind of standard. I don't even know if they're standard, but they're not amorphous process groups, but rather fairly structured, very targeted toward teaching those who attend the group, teaching them how to engage in attentional regulation through mindfulness training or core mindfulness, and then regulating learning how to downregulate strong emotions and handling crisis behaviors with distress tolerance skills, in which these are very embodied practices, by the way, and then really looking at how do we build resilience or reduce vulnerability to reactivity through emotion regulation training. And then, of course, we have interpersonal effectiveness skill training, which is targeting relationships. And so, it is different than just talk therapy, you know, because we are really looking at helping people connect with their whole selves, you know, in terms of, for instance, with mindfulness. If it's okay with you, just wanted to go ahead and just say that
absolutely,
part of the strength of mindfulness for an ADHD person, there is, of course, and the other researchers are seeing this also, and I'm going to mention them in some of their books even that might be helpful to your listeners. I can say, you know, just from the fact that I myself am an ADHD adult, and so in some ways I've considered it over the years, like, wow, what a tremendous blessing for me that I got to become a DBT therapist also. And it was still years before, you know, I was diagnosed when I was about 30 years old. It'd still be years later that I would turn my attention toward really learning more about the science behind ADHD per se. But I can tell you one of the first things that helped me immediately, and I've been working this with some of my patients currently, with mindfulness, you know, there's a practice of one layer of the practice is self-acceptance, letting go of judgment. And so there's a lot of conservation of energy because there's a practice there that's an invitation to letting go, projecting this hyper competence, you know, particularly for adults, I think, that they can't muster, but they have to, you know, they have to function with other adults and their peers. But then there's also the real you, and this is what I was doing. But when I received my diagnosis and then turned this practice toward the reality that I'm an ADHD adult, there came kind of a relief because I didn't have to waste my time projecting hyper-competent Scott, and then the real Scott, it was just like, I'm real Scott. That's that. Because the projection I was putting out wasn't fooling anybody else anyway. In fact,
that was really about just you learning to accept who you were as a person.
Yeah.
Through mindfulness, you learned that.
Yeah. Because one of the components of that, also one of the principles that are dialectics, that we are faced with polarities. And the chief dialectic in DBT is the tension between acceptance and change, which was relating to one of our treatment assumptions, and that is everybody is doing the absolute best they possibly can in any given moment. However bad it looks on the outside to others or subpar, that's the best it can be. And everybody needs to do better, try harder, and be more motivated to change. And so there's that kind of constant potential for growth, while also learning to accept oneself, where you are, your present level of skillfulness in a particular context, and so on, and kind of growing that way.
Yeah, I think that's so interesting because I think it's again, I just go back to it's an interesting therapeutic approach because there is talk about how to be mindful, but there's not a lot of resources, I guess, to help a parent, help a child or a teenager or a young adult learn how to be mindful. It's almost like they're expected to be motivated to want to go seek how to do that, where I feel like the DBT therapy kind of just incorporates that into the practice about learning how to, just even planting seeds about what mindfulness is and different ways of, as you explained, accepting yourself or accepting oneself, right? For just who they are and where they are in their life and that they're continuing to grow and learn.
Right. Yeah. And I think by way of, families, because, I work with a few families that have, say, primary school age children that are presented with ADHD, and working with the parents primarily, assisting them with mindfulness approach to relationships and, relationship acceptance. This is, the best that my child can actually do. And many of my particular expectations may may not, well, they don't match reality. So to put this way, it's an invitation also in that, you know, accepting your child where they are. And just to be clear for anybody who will hear this, is that we don't mean approval. We don't mean that we approve of, you know, maybe inappropriate behavior or substandard academic performance and these kinds of things, but that we really can meet ourselves and our child where they are, and we can turn the focus of our support of the child to the relationship and still really fostering healthy attachment with the child, winning the relationship versus winning particular expectations or, you know, battles, if you will, running arguments. So there's also a very heavy practice in validation that we can learn. This is, you know, again, the things are as they are, and in DBT, validation is very, very important, whether you're the therapist working with somebody with BPD or ADHD or otherwise. And that's really simply the practice of conveying to another person, whether that's your child, your partner, yourself, I take you seriously and I understand you. And I, you know, maybe even expressing that, you know, I don't really understand where you come from, but I'm definitely interested in finding out and learning how we can truly be supportive to you. You know, I'd say probably with children, our end game is probably helping them cultivate as much inner congruence as they can have, and internal congruence and integrity, if you will, or integration, so that they can grow into being, you know, relatively healthy, confident adults.
Yeah. So it's actually an option too for parents for parent education of really learning how to support their child with ADHD.
Yes, I think so. You know, the parents I'm working with, you know, part of what we're working on with them is, you know, educating parents about, again, you know, mindfulness and being aware of, you know, what are my expectations or my own reactivities to, you know, my child, or, you know, expectations I have that maybe I can see and assess that, oh, I'm not really implementing a coaching with my child to help them understand what the expectation is, and then equipping them with the tools to be able to meet that expectation.
Right.
And some of that might even be the foundational practices of, you know, more a parent learns to regulate their emotions, because that would be part of the practice also, is, you know, how are you dancing with your own emotions as the grown-ups, so that you're increasingly self-regulated and maybe having to, you know, deal with your own scripts from your own family of origin and your own childhood.
Yes.
How are you dealing with your own impulsivity, and, you know, and then working from a place of how can I keep cultivating a sense of emotional safety, you know, with my kids, so that, you know, they're not maybe concealing or hiding from me or feeling resentful, or, you know, and likewise, if I'm the parent, I'm not getting too locked into my own rigid expectations and feeling angry and disappointed, and then, you know, further alienating my child because I don't hide that with my, you know, grimacing or my grunting or my rolling of the eyes and,
right,
and so on. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And does DBT talk a little bit about the exposure, I guess, and like navigating the social scene, whether that be, and social, I mean, like with family dynamics, it could be for a young person, you know, in the school social scene, mm-hmm. either with friends or teachers, like does DBT help some, like an ADHD child where it might not be natural for them to figure out how to get what they want, right? Does
right.
DBT, the practice of that, help them kind of build some skills around how to navigate whatever social scene that would be? And I would imagine as an ADHD person gets older, right, and as in the workplace, how to mm-hmm. express themselves and get what they want, or at least ask for what they want from a boss or from a teacher or from their friends or from their parents.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. What does DBT help them with that when it comes to that kind of stuff?
Well, you know, there's definitely the potential for that. And I would say that comes through, of course, you know, we have the underlying core practice of mindfulness and just kind of building that, you know, self-awareness as much as we can for any person that would be willing to undertake that practice. In part, realizing, for instance, becoming more aware of how I come off to others. You know, looking at that from an adult standpoint, I've met a lot of adults who have had a lot of jobs, and they have a lot of jobs because they lose a lot of jobs. Also, they're losing jobs because not because there's any problem with intelligence or skill for the job, but their social interactions are such as perhaps that they're telling inappropriate jokes and offending people, but not really understanding why it was, you know, offensive, or, you know, maybe it was an impulsive comment. Right. They regret it. So how do I, then am I indignant about the way, if I receive a corrective action in the workplace or from my peers? So yes, with mindfulness practice in part, it's realizing that, oh, that's a social faux pas. And, oh, I can correct that. I can actually engage in relationship repair, or I can open myself to take responsibility for the realization that my actions do prompt reactions from others that may, you know, draw me closer to them or increase my, you know, my perceived value in a workplace, for example, or connections with peers at school or otherwise. Or, if I don't have that, I'm strictly running blind from, you know, maybe embarrassment or shame, then that may reinforce my, you know, isolation or my withdrawal, you know, from others, which really then reduces an opportunity to develop those three-dimensional daily life skills in interacting with peers. Also, in DBT, we do have, with interpersonal effectiveness, we do a lot, we're really into acronyms in DBT. And one of our most famous acronyms in interpersonal effectiveness is what we call a dear man, give fast skills. And the dear man skills, and I don't necessarily know that we want to unpack all of these letter by letter in the short time that we have. But the dear man skills are really geared toward. And before I get into
well, what does dear man mean?
Well,
do you remember? Am I putting you on the spot?
Yeah, you're putting me on the spot, but it's okay. It's a great test for me. So it's describe. So describe what you want from others. Express. Be very expressive. You know, be congruent in expression, so that you're more likely to that you're on target for increasing the likelihood that you get something that you want from others. Appear confident. So, you know, no stammering or, you know, being embarrassed or distracted, anything like that. R is reinforce. And the reinforcing means give people the opportunity or express to them in some way, make it reinforcing for the other person to give you what it is that you're looking for. Right.
Verbally remind them what you're asking for. Is that reinforce?
Yeah. It could be, you know, sometimes it's just as simple as saying, hey, by the way, you know, maybe you're looking for a raise, you know, if you're an adult, you know, you go to your boss, you know, you want to be descriptive, you want to be expressive, and you also want to be, I'm sorry, it wasn't appear confident, that's in the man. You want to be, again, describe what you want to say. I've been working for, I'm really looking for a raise. And here are all the reasons why I think that I bring value to here. And, you know, what do you think? So, and being assertive, right, means that you're not going to be, kind of passive aggressive, like being mad, like nobody ever gives me a raise. I never get notified, you know, everything. But also doesn't mean you go into the office, and, you know, with your manager and say, I want the raise or else. Dun, dun, dun.
Right. Know?
Right. We would find that sweet spot right there in the middle. So, and then the reinforce could be like, it would really mean a lot to me. It would be very meaningful to me. It would really enhance the motivation I already have to keep doing the great job I'm doing now. And so sometimes for a lot of relational situations, just even that's enough.
Yeah.
Or, nice. You know, if you could give me $5, you know, if it's a friend, if you could give me $5 for gas money, which I guess really wouldn't get you too far these days. you know, that would be really helpful to me so I could get to a job interview. And then I don't know when I can pay you back, but I'll try to get you back as soon as I can. So being open and honest about that. And then the man stands for, you know, M is be mindful. You know, so in other words, don't get sidelined by any kind of crosstalk or the other person becoming distracted or, you know, maybe they're, you know, maybe being critical in some way. You know, maybe the manager you're asking for a raise says, well, Yeah, I can see what you're saying, but 3 months ago you were late to work by 15 minutes. So are you sure you're really up for a raise? And then that would be like a great time to say, well, be that as it may, that was 3 months ago. It hasn't happened since. So you just stay, focused on, what you're looking for. And then the A in man is where we want to appear confident. We want to come off as though we are competent. And a lot of us, a lot of people with ADHD are more competent than they give themselves credit for. And then N is for negotiate. So, just be willing to, maybe take a partial offer to your response. Or if, it's up to you, maybe you decide like they say, well, maybe not now, but let's revisit this next week or next month. Or I need to talk to my higher ups and see if we can get you that raise.
Right.
Take that, take that. So in other words, be flexible in what's happening there. So dear man is used to ask for things from others. It could be change behavior, get a raise, or it can also be a no. How do I say no to persons? And able to learn, and they also do a lot of practice with intensifying or softening intensity of that on either direction. So that's the dear man. Give is really, those are the soft skills. It's G is be gentle, I is act interested, G is validate, and E is, use an easy manner. And so sometimes our, again, ADHD kids and adults, in their impulsivity, or if they're, if they're kind of distracted in their own thinking, or they're maybe overly concerned about coming off wrong, they don't think about the importance of the tone of voice, or really listening to others, or some way finding out, well, what's important to you. If we go back to the job, or if we go back to the trying to get a raise example. Well, I don't know. I don't know what I can do. I need to talk to my higher ups. And you could, be gentle and say, hey, well, I really appreciate you talking to those folks for me. That really means a lot to me. I appreciate that. And I can see that you're in a situation where you need to do that. So that's validation, because I take your situation seriously. I don't jump in there and keep, well, you can make up your mind right now. Just use it, can use the soft skills, because then we lower, the defensiveness in others, right? We're helping, we're regulating our own amygdala. And we're helping
Yeah.
others regulate their amygdalas also. And just using an easy manner. And then the dear man, give fast. So fast is be fair to yourself and others in social situations. And then the A is, don't make apologies for having certain views or beliefs or practices, and don't change those unless you have, or just don't apologize for your position on things. So in other words, don't change your mind for something that's, unless you have very important reasons to do so, but not just out of shame or trying to get a quick fix for a connection or something like that.
Yeah, I think it's good. It gives like a lot of interpersonal skill development to really learn how to be flexible in
There's a
your
lot of role play.
thinking
Because
about what you're doing when you're wanting to interact with somebody who you're not maybe close and comfortable with, right?
Right. That's right. So, and there's a lot of other strategies also, just, things like, you kind of, you're going to have to risk, in some way. If you want to, like, if you're low on friendships or connections, or you're overly lonely, again, we can, utilizing mindfulness as the core skill around which we build everything else. So these are all integrated. So we only talk about them as though they're sort of, separate, because we have to. But join a club, join a sport, go to church, go, join a particular club of some kind that, you might be interested in, but put yourself around other people and validating yourself. Like, sometimes that's kind of hard, because although I might pine for connection with my peers, where, again, whether that's in school as a kid, or, an adult, later on, whether it's the workplace or otherwise, sometimes there's, anxiety and self-doubt and these sort of things. We need these other skills also to kind of, like, we're going to contend with that as well. So it's not like just go meet people and you'll magically have friendships.
Yeah.
When you go meet people, then you'll, let's plan ahead a little bit. Let's think about, like, what has tended to, alienate you from others in the past. What do you think has been problematic, and or what are judgments, reactive internal cognitive interpretations you make about others? Maybe you're already coming in with sort of hostile cognition, like, they're just not going to like me, they're just not going to like me. with mindfulness practices, kind of like we're just going to watch that. We notice those, we acknowledge them, and we become more skilled at not holding on to that in a manner of speaking, but also not invalidating yourselves and just kind of squishing it, with suppression or trying to kind of dissociate ourselves from our emotions, but just really acknowledging our thoughts and emotions as they happen. And then opening some internal space. Again, this is a repetitive practice where we can choose. We become more skilled at, first of all, seeing that we have more than just one or two options in a lot of situations. And that, of course, the more we repeat, the more skilled we become. And then from the therapist point of view, or if we were talking to parents of children that we're asking to engage in some of these strategies, we need to look for ways that are effectively reinforcing for them so they can generalize those skills.
I just think it's an amazing kind of therapeutic tool that tends to lend itself to kind of, I think, a lot of how ADHD kids and adults struggle, that it kind of helps give them something to think about and learn, and to build some skills that can help them in their lives. I like too how you suggested, helping them put themselves out there when it comes to clubs or playing a sport or joining the church. What's your guidance, just curiosity, with like engaging online and kind of using online as your community? Is that hurtful or helpful? Or
wow, that's a
that's a whole other question. I was just curious.
Well, that's a real, so this is strictly my present opinion, which I'll always hold the right to edit later. But my present opinion, which is also modified from, I'm a stepfather to three boys, and I have come to appreciate that it's not all bad online. It's not all, the older boys do a bit of gaming, and they talk to people online. And that's something that, for me, my video games, it was the 80s. I was at an arcade to play a quarter, get three lives and then it's over,
Right.
And so once I kind of plugged in with this, the reality that, there are people that they're talking to that they've never met, and they are very safe. And so online, not strictly bad. I'd still recommend, though, that we're checking in with our kids about, well, who do you know, who are you talking to? Make sure you're not giving away too much, personal information. And if we're fostering relationships with our kids in a way where, hey, look, if anything gets strange or weird or something's not right, you feel like there's somebody out there being predatory or bullying, we want them to feel safe enough to come to us to talk about it.
That's good.
So I don't want to treat it all like, that's just a bunch of garbage and you're wasting your life on there. And we limit the amount of time that they spend there, in part because we still want them interacting with us. We want to be the primary influence as much as we can be in terms of, just life and values and so on. And then we also want them, hopefully out doing things like working a job interacting with peers in the real world, where they can exercise, kind of a more in natural context. How do you exercise, emotional maturity, and how do you deal with things when people look at you weird or say something mean or they're impatient with you, and you're going to be okay, and it's just part of life. And, this is, we want you to be, prepared for this in the future. So, and there's even been some literature I've seen online. I haven't done a deep dive on it, but it suggests that in some ways, there's a modicum of, problem solving, skill development that can come with some of these games that are played online. And then there's also some socialization.
Yeah.
And then there's a lot of literature out there that also says too much of that, then we end up with kids who are isolated and unable to actually form relationships with people, in the flesh and blood. So I'd say my advice would be, pay attention. Let them have some fun, but just know what they're doing, know where they are online. That may even include, reviewing their, browsing histories and other things like that.
Yeah.
And
be mindful of how long you're spending online.
Yeah. And then
very
also,
well
I think,
said.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And then also it's important for us, if we're modeling for our kids, what are our internet habits? Maybe it's too much Twitter. Maybe it's too much doom scrolling. So I think it's what's good for the goose is good for the gander. Our youngest boy, he's only 8. He's pretty good about saying, "Everybody's been on their screens too long. Let's do something."
Oh, I love that. He's
All right, let's do it,
good. Good advice. Okay, Scott, so as a DBT therapist, is there any like overarching words of wisdom that you would share with parents who are raising ADHD kids? Like, at what point do you think a parent should consider seeking out therapy and maybe considering DBT therapy? Like, at what point would a parent need to consider that as a possible resource to support them?
I think if there's if you're noticing patterns of if you're falling into patterns of intractable polarizing arguments, or you're feeling kind of the chronic push to control the child, and or if you're feeling that you're falling into the pattern of focusing more on punishment and deprivation as your primary tool for discipline, those might be signs that you want to look for therapy. And I'd say start with yourself. I'd say look for coaching, books, tools, therapy for yourself to start with. In other words, because if we can learn about dealing with our own emotions and thoughts and expectations, we can become more flexible. And we can find more creative ways to, connect with our kids. I'm also very influenced by the work of Dan Siegel and interpersonal neurobiology, MindSight, whole brain child, and those sort of things. And so very much, I think there's a lot of wisdom to be gleaned there, which I think is very compatible with DBT practices. So how do we create an environment of safety and connection with our kids? And that starts with us. That's our responsibility as the grown-ups. And maybe we don't have those tools, or maybe we didn't have them, or maybe we're pretty skillful, but we just don't know how to connect with our kids who are a lot more, overly, or maybe hypersensitive to feedback and correction. So, rather than just sort of trying to squeeze it out of them, if we can learn some tools on, again, becoming more cognitively flexible, more emotionally regulated, but also learning ourselves on how to validate our kiddos. Again, that's just you're really taking it seriously. Yeah, this is really hard for you. Okay, so this method of study time doesn't work for you. So we're going to keep working on it, kiddo. And by the way, we're all in it together. We're in this thing together. And we're going to learn some skills for emotion coaching the kids too, and really, really helping them understand that, hey, it's okay that you feel that way. And by the way, we're going to help you learn vocabulary for that. We're going to help you learn how to do self-soothing and distraction and so on, because you're going to need those skills later anyway. And then also be willing to, learn how to apologize when it's appropriate in terms of relationship repair. So a lot of parents are afraid of, well, if I apologize, I lose my parental authority. Like, not really. You still set limits. So, for instance, if you have a teenager who broke curfew and you kind of went bananas and yelled a little bit as you grounded them later, you can go back and say, you know what, honey, I kind of overreacted. I don't like talking to you like that. You're still grounded, but I just want to let you know that. I'm going to work on how it is that I talk to you because I respect you and I love you. And so, but I think start with self and then find, if you can find a program where you can also work with the kids, that's great. But the kids, in my opinion, whether they're teens or younger, they're going to need the family to be involved in some level of learning how to, again, validate, learn effective ways of helping kids acquire skill. And then find out how can I, on a relational level, become a reinforcing factor so that more adaptive skills actually work in our home environment. Because a therapist can teach a kid all kinds of great stuff, but if they go home and the parents or school is just pushing against that, and they're met with continued invalidation or even punishment for trying to be adaptive, those skills won't take. So really, it kind of starts with us. So I think if we start go out and look for help, we can work on that. And then maybe we can get the kid integrated in there too. And then we can again make it a big family shared effort.
And it turns back to the parent kind of ultimately being the CEO because they got to manage their family and the school. And you can use, right? It's both of those. And So anyway, I really appreciate this, Scott. This was a really good conversation about what DBT is and what it can teach even a parent and child. It's really kind of a cool therapeutic tool that I think is available for people. And you don't learn about these things until you have kids with like ADHD or whatever it may be. Right. And then as you start, you know, for personally, if I, once you start exploring and looking at resources that are available, there are things like DBT therapists who are out there with actually some fabulous tools that can be very helpful, for children with, ADHD and who struggle, maybe socially. And I think with anxiety and depression or any of those things that are creeping up in a family's life, that DBT can be very helpful. Yeah. And it feels more peaceful to me, I think, because of the mindfulness piece, that it's really, kind of this calming, peaceful approach to getting through our problems in life.
Yeah. And if I just one more piece of advice I'd probably offer parents about looking for DBT specific help. I would look, research your practitioners a little bit, because not all practitioners are created equal. But if you happen to find, you can look for providers or programs that are Linehan board certified DBT practitioners. That would be gold standard. These are folks that have really done a lot of work on adherent DBT. They've gone through some very rigorous training.
Okay. Who's Linehan? Is that the woman who created DBT?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Yeah. Is her name Michelle?
No, Marsha.
Oh, Marsha Linehan.
Marsha Linehan. Yeah.
Okay.
PhD. And then, you know, and then aside from that, not everybody who's quality DBT has that certification per se, but if they have some kind of Linehan, training, and foundational training in with behavioral tech. So and then I would just, you know, if you end up talking with,
hold on, what's behavioral tech?
Behavioral tech's that's a company that was started by Marsha Linehan to provide DBT training, all the levels, for beginning practitioners all the way to comprehensive training. So
okay, good to know.
Yeah. So those are, you know, just ask questions about how that person, you know, how skilled are they, or, you know, what's their education in DBT, and so on. I think those would be important to kind of look for, you know, quality providers.
Yeah, that's a hot tip. Thank you for sharing that.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Hey, anything else, Scott, before we wrap it up?
No, I'd say, you know, kind of going back to your question just before that, you know, in terms of some big takeaways, I think the big punchline for DBT overall traditionally has been building a life worth living. And that's kind of the major thing we're all going for. So I'd say try to keep that in mind, big picture, you know, and then I'd say put the relationship before tasks and other potential associated minutiae and arguments. So,
it's a dance for sure.
It is for sure. But thank you for having me today.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
I hope it was helpful.
It was very helpful. Thank you, Scott.